Well, the bad news is that New Tricks is finished. There will be no more episodes, and for someone whose life revolves around the only TV I usually ever get to watch is Murder Mysteries, then this is a very sad moment. However, I am cheered up by the fact that the X-Files are coming back. They have made 6 new programs. They're currently on in the States. I'm not quite sure when they come to the UK, but that's a good thing as opposed to the bad thing. Personally, I blame this ongoing fascination with murder mystery series, you know, whether it's things like Midsommar Murders or Frost or Silent Witness or whatever. Personally, I blame it on the things I read as a child because when I was young and growing up, the only technology there was books. I mean, the television was black and white. And it was awful. And so the books was, that was what you did to kind of pass the time. And I read a lot of books as a child. I read the Biggles stories. I read the Billy Bunter stories. I read loads of Enid Blyton. And my favorite Enid Blyton series was the Barney Mysteries. I'm looking around for any kind of sign of... Okay, well, maybe you'll remember the titles. The Rub-A-Dub Mystery. Yeah? No? Ring of Bells... Rocking Down, Rillaby Fair. At the first service, somebody nodded at one of them. Yes, Barbara. Good, Barbara. Excellent. Yeah, okay. So they were my favorite ones. There were 6 mysteries in the series. I think I read most of them at least twice. And I blame that now for my fascination with murder mysteries as an adult. It's because mysteries are interesting things. You know, they can't be solved. There's something strange about them. And Paul says something unusual about the Christian faith in those verses from 1 Timothy chapter 3. Beyond all question, he says, the mystery from which true godliness springs is great. He appeared in the flesh, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels, was preached among the nations, was believed in on the world, was taken up in glory. Our faith is a mystery. It's not a murder mystery, fortunately, but it's a mystery. A mystery is something which is difficult or impossible to understand or explain. That's one of the problems about the Christian faith. It isn't easy to explain. I sat on Wednesday evening with a young man at our Alpha course, and he had come out of his group, and we spent some time out in the foyer of the hotel talking about the fact that although he grew up in a Christian home, and went to church an awful lot as a child, he'd come to a point in his life where none of it made sense anymore. And he kept saying, he said, Sean, come on. I mean, seriously, like, the things that happen in the Bible, you're not trying to tell me you actually believe that they're true. Really? How can they be true? They don't make sense. And Paul's saying this here, just as that young man was bearing testimony in his own life and saying, this stuff doesn't make sense. Paul says, godliness is a great mystery. Now, there was context to this in Paul's day. Because when Paul used that word mystery about the gospel, it rang a bell in his generation. Because in the Roman Empire in which Paul lived, okay, the Roman Empire was religion mad. There was the state-sponsored religion, which was largely around almost like sort of emperor worship, really. And a lot of the temples that were strewn across Roman Europe are still visible today, mostly in ruins, but that you can see them. And those temples would have been part of the state-sponsored religion, the worship of the emperor. But aside from that, then, there were all the kind of what you might call normal religions, okay? So they were religions of the peoples that the Roman Empire had conquered. Amongst them, for example, was Judaism, was the worship of Yahweh, because the Israelites had been conquered and were now moving freely around the Roman Empire. And as the Roman Empire moved eastward, so a lot of the Eastern religions got drawn in. So Buddhism and Hinduism and so on would have been known as well. So you had a second layer of religion. But then there was a third layer. And the third layer of religion were called mystery cults. Mystery cults, because they recognized the fact that life was inexplicable, that all the big questions of life don't have obvious answers. And to plot your course through a world which is complicated and difficult and understand how you should live and how you should die, people needed to know about these things. But nobody knew the secret. Well, nobody but this particular cult. And so these cults operated like secret societies with passwords and code words and funny kinds of dress and different rituals. And you would get admitted to them. And what the draw of the mystery religions was they told you that they understood all these mysteries about life. And if you joined them, they would explain them to you. And then you would know how to live and how to die. And there were a legion of them in the Roman Empire in Paul's day. And they traded in esoteric knowledge. They traded in teaching you what you couldn't work out for yourself so you could live a better life, die a better death. Mystery cults. So when Paul said that godliness, that faith in Jesus Christ was a mystery, it rang a bell. But what's really interesting about this is while Paul admits that it's a mystery, it's hard to understand and not fully explainable, he didn't see the church as relating to the world the way the mystery cults did. The mystery cults thought their job was to teach you a different way, to give you the secret of life and of the universe so you could live by it. That wasn't how Paul saw the church operating at all. And because this is our Vision Sunday as well, we're trying to refresh and renew our idea of who we are as a church and what we believe God has called us to do. I want to think for a minute or two about what Paul says about the role of the church when we have a faith that is essentially a mystery, cannot be fully explained in normal human terms. People like that young man that I was talking to on Wednesday evening understand that this doesn't make sense. So what should the church do? What is our role? Paul points it out here with three powerful pictures that I want us to think about for a minute or two. Paul says here that the church, through these pictures, should become some things. If we were to be the church that God has called us to be, then first of all, we will become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's. That's the first thing. Because faith is a mystery, the role of the church, first of all, is to become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's. Paul's first picture is that the church is God's household. We read that a moment or two ago in that letter to Timothy. The church is God's household. Now, households were familiar enough in the Roman Empire and in the church. A household was sort of like our home. But more than that, a Roman household would have usually a husband and wife and a number of children. But the Roman household would have more than that. If it was a wealthy household, it would have servants. It might even have staff of some sort. And it might even not just have one generation living there. It mightn't just be husband and wife and their children. But parents or grandparents might be in that home as well. So it was a household. It was quite a big group of people living in a fairly large space. And in the New Testament, you find households mentioned all the time. Because in the early church, the church was born in households. And you find them mentioned in the New Testament. For example, Lydia, who was the businesswoman who came to faith in Philippi and started the church meeting in her house. It was Lydia's household. And you get other households mentioned. For example, Chloe in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Stephanus in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Onesiphorus in 2 Timothy 1 and 4. So the church met in households. And though such households existed in Ephesus, no doubt, because this letter that Paul writes to Timothy was going to the church at Ephesus, because that's where Timothy was working at the time. Although there were these households in Ephesus, Paul doesn't mention them by name. He says, you are not the household of Stephanas or Chloe or Lydia or whatever. You are God's household. What do you mean by that? Well, the reality is that in a Roman household, the head of the house made the key decisions. So although there would be discussion maybe between husband and wife, and children might be consulted, or parents might be consulted, servants and staff from time to time might be consulted, in the end of the day, the household of Stephanas was run by Stephanas. So when Paul says that the church is God's household, what is he saying? He was saying that the church was God's to direct, and it still is. It was God's to direct, and it still is. We will become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's, of belonging to him. And what that means, loads of things, but one of the things it means is that we should expect his direct intervention in our decision-making. Because that's what happened in a Roman household. The head of the household would intervene in the decision-making processes of the household to direct, to decide sometimes, to end discussion and say, right, this is what we're going to do. We should expect the Lord to do that. For example, because we are going to give over the next period of time £2.4 million to pay for that, that's going up behind us right now. Because we're going to give £2.4 million to pay for that church center does not give us the right to determine how it should be used. I know we think it does. We think it's ours. We paid for it. So we can decide who uses it and when they use it and what sorts of activities take place within it. But you know what, guys? God has an opinion about that. And actually, even though we're going to give the money that will pay for it, it belongs to him. And he will want to tell us how he wants it to be used. God is going to call us into new directions through things like that. He's going to say, I want you to invest in this. I want you to open it to that. I want these things to happen, because that's who he is. And he's going to call us into different ways of making decisions, because this is God's household. So he's going to want to have an involvement in that. If you look at the, you know, sometimes if we are wrestling with leadership issues here in church, we would just love it if it was possible for example, Paul and Barnabas to show up. I can imagine us sitting in a committee meeting some evening, or a session meeting some evening, or a core team meeting some evening, and not knowing what to do or what it is the Lord would want us to do. And all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door, and you open the door, and Paul and Barnabas walk in. Well, you would think you were made. You'd say, wow, they'll know what God wants us to do. Tell us, Paul. Tell us, Barnabas, what should we do? And whatever they said, we'd do it. But here's the funny thing. Paul and Barnabas were leaders in the church at Antioch, and they weren't the only leaders. There was all these other gifted guys as well. They're listed in Acts chapter 13. They didn't know what it was God wanted them to do in Antioch. God had to tell them directly. What they did was they waited on the Lord in fasting and prayer and worship, and they waited on God to find out what God wanted them to do, and God spoke up. He said, I tell you what I want you to do. I want you to take Paul and Barnabas and set them free and send them out. We got a whole of Europe to win. Send them out. And that's what they did. But they only found out what they needed to do, not by sitting down and figuring it out themselves, but by waiting on God to tell them. And the more we become the church of Jesus Christ, the more we become conscious of being the Lord's, that this is his church, that this is his household, that this is his ministry, his mission, and we need to know what it is he wants us to do. We're so bad at waiting on God because we always think we have it sussed ourselves. I was involved in 1997 in the General Assembly's denomination-wide church conference, which we call 2020 Vision, and it was held in Coleraine. It was probably the largest event in terms of a church conference the PCI has ever organized, because we got the big tent, and so we were able to have thousands of people there. And the Presbyterian Church in Ireland at that time did what the Presbyterian Church in Ireland frequently does. When it has a new event to organize, here's what it tends to do. It looks for two people who don't agree with each other, and who aren't even particularly close, and they put them together and make them co-conveners. And then they give them 10 or 12 other people who they don't agree with, some of whom they probably don't even like, and they lump them all together and say, now go away and do something that's actually going to work. I don't know why anybody ever thought that was a good idea, but basically that's what we keep doing, and that's what they did that year. So Trevor Morrow and I, who knew each other, but who, the direction of whose ministries was going very much in different ways at that time. The Lord has changed that since, but at that time, that's the way it was. We were just thrown together to do this, and then we were given a bunch of other people, half of whom we didn't even know. So how on earth were we going to make this work? So what we decided we would do was we would go away for a weekend together. Before we did any planning or discussing or arguing about what this conference should look like and who should be the speakers at it and so on, we'd go away and we'll take a weekend away together, and that's what we did. And on the Friday evening of the weekend, Ken Newell was one of the people on the team. And we asked Ken to sort of lead a prayer thing on the Friday night. So we kind of thought what Ken would do is what you tend to do at church stuff. You know, you all get together in a room, you bow your heads, you close your eyes, and then you spend a bit of time talking to God. And it's not particularly exciting sometimes. And sometimes people pray prayers they're not really that interested in, but there's been a silence for a long time now, so you better fill the gap with something. We thought that's what it would be, but that isn't what Ken did. He divided us up into small groups. And he said, so I'm sitting in a seat and there's someone on my left-hand side. And he said to me, right, John, I want you to tell the person on your left-hand side something about your life, what God's doing in your life right now. Then I also want you to tell that person something that you really need God to intervene in right now. And then I want that person on your left-hand side to pray for you. And then the person on my left would do that and do that right around the room until eventually I prayed for the person that was on my right. And it was an incredible moment, because all of a sudden, everything changed. Because we were waiting on God now. We were giving thanks to God for things that God was already doing in the lives of these people. We didn't think God was doing anything in their lives. We didn't agree with them at all. You know, we didn't even want to be there with them. And then we discovered God was at work in their lives, doing things. And then these people were becoming vulnerable and saying, well, this is what's wrong and I need God to help me with this. And we were praying for that. Changed everything. Because we stopped to listen to God. Amazing things happened as a result of that. I remember when we came to discuss later who would be the keynote speakers for the conference. And this was bound to be an issue where there was going to be a problem. We would never agree on this. You know, to bring somebody, because it had to be somebody international. It's an absolutely incredible thing in that we were just brainstorming names, you know, and my co-leader, Trevor, said right away the name of the person I'd been thinking of for months before that time, whose books I loved, and I thought, this is the guy we need to bring to the conference. And it was the first name out of his mouth. And I think everything changed because we spent that time waiting on God. We acknowledged that if this conference was to do any good at all, it had to be the Lord's and not ours. And church is church when we become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's, of wanting to know what He wants us to do, of expecting Him to intervene in our decision-making processes and take us in directions we never thought. It's not ours. It's His, and the more we become church, the more we understand that. So we want to become a church increasingly conscious of being the Lord's. But secondly, we will become a church increasingly infused with life. Paul's first picture that we've been thinking about comes from the household, from everyday life. His second picture comes from the world of politics. Because secondly, he says that we are the church of the living God. The word that is translated church is the Greek word ekklesia. That word means an assembly, and it's a word from the world of politics. Greek cities and other kind of political units within the Greek and Roman Empire often had assemblies. Now, it wasn't one man, one vote and all. It's not democracy as we recognize it. But there was a level of consultation and discussion built in especially to the Greek Empire, and the Romans took that over. And so cities would often have assemblies where people would meet to discuss issues that affected the city. And the word that would be used to describe that meeting was ecclesia, which then became church. Paul says this assembly is the assembly of the living God. What is he saying here? Saying that this is an assembly which not only has people in it, but has the presence of God with it. And the God who is present when we meet is the living God, the life giving God. What God does is never tedious or boring or destructive, but only life-giving. Isn't that what Jesus said? I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. And that means, therefore, that if we are the ecclesia, the assembly of the living God, when we meet and God is present, we will see him at work more and more. In Luke chapter 5, it says this: one day Jesus was teaching, and Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting there. They had come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem, and the power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal the sick. The power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal the sick. If this is the assembly of the living God, if that's what church means, then more and more we are a place which is infused with life, the life of God. You should expect that if you come here, that God will address the needs that you come with, that he has power to do something about them, and that when God's people gather, they are infused with this life more and more, so that people come, their lives are touched, and their needs are met. Not only so, but something else happens. Because we are the assembly of the living God, people gathered with the life-giving Lord, then we become attractive too. We become attractive too. I don't know about you, maybe you've never met any people like this, but occasionally in my life I meet people, and often they're lovely people, you know, and they're really good people and all the rest of it. But if you spend 10 minutes in their company, they suck all the life out of you. Just in the first 30 seconds, virtually. So by the time you've finished having a conversation with them, you need to go and lie down somewhere for an hour or two to recover your energy again, because it's just something about them. You can feel it, like it just gets pulled out of you and into them. They go away happy as Larry, and you're dead at the end of the conversation. And so many people can be like that. And, you know, maybe for people who come from the world looking for something, come into the church, that's the last thing you need to happen. You don't want people to come in here and leave worse than they were when they came. But when the life of God is infused into our lives, instead of sucking the life out of other people, we give life. Jesus talked about believers being people out of whose hearts would flow rivers of living water. So you can't be with them, but you get soaked all the time. You're just drenched in this flow of the life of God in other people's lives. That's what church is meant to be like. That people come in here out of the world, desperate, in need, looking for an answer, looking for help, looking for something. They don't know what they're looking for. They're just here because they know they need it. And they come into the assembly of the living God, the ecclesia, the church. The life-giving Lord is among them. So the whole thing is infused with life. You ask somebody, you want to come to my church on Sunday? Say, yes, please. Yes, please. We become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's. What we do with our stuff, how we organize our church, how we make our decisions is about what he wants and not what we want. More and more, that's what we're going to desire. More and more, we're going to wait on him. We're going to expect him to tell us what he wants us to do. We become increasingly infused with life. The power of the Lord was with Jesus to heal the sick. This is a life-giving place, or it should be, if we are truly church. Lastly, we will become focused on Jesus. The third picture doesn't come from the home or from politics, but from architecture. And now we enter a realm I know absolutely nothing about, Michael. And if what I'm just about to say is ridiculous, you pardon me for it, but I don't know anything really about it anyway. But Paul says finally that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. You can't miss pillars on this site right now, because behind us here, you can see them. I look out of my office window every day, and they're just a few feet outside my window, these huge steel columns that are going to bear the weight of the roof and the first floor in the building that's going up out there. And they're massive, and you can't miss them. Pillars. Paul uses two words here that are not very common in the New Testament. The word for pillar only occurs three times here and two other occasions in the Bible. The word that's translated foundation is not the normal word which is translated foundation, because this is the only time it ever occurs in the Bible in this verse. And it might not mean foundation at all. It might mean something like a stay or a support. And I noticed in that building during the week there that if you look at it, there's these massive big steel columns coming up, and then there's another set of quite big columns going up at an angle to support the roof. But there are cross pieces in between the columns. I assume they're there to prevent the columns from moving apart, but I'm looking for a nod. Yeah, I'm getting a nod. Yeah, that's what they're there for. That's what I thought. But when they came the other week to put the first floor in, the big concrete slabs that you're going to be walking on and sitting on, God willing, in a few months' time, when they came to put those big slabs in, they couldn't get them through because of the cross pieces. So they had to unbolt them, move them back, drop the floor in, and then bolt them back again. They couldn't just take them away and say, those things are a nuisance, they're in the way, take them away, we don't need them. You do need them because they're going to hold the whole thing together. And that's maybe what Paul was talking about. Pillars and supports. They are the frame that keeps the building together, that forms its shape. Now, what's interesting is Paul says that the pillars and foundation, if you like, as it's translated in the NIV, the pillars and foundation is what? It's us. That isn't what you expect. The church as the pillar and foundation of the truth, you think that's the wrong way around. Surely the truth is the foundation of the church. Surely it's that way around. But that's not what Paul says. He says the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. What on earth can he possibly mean by that? But here's what it means. It means that Jesus and all he was and all he did is a mystery. That's what Paul says. Every aspect of who he is and what he does is a mystery. You cannot fully explain it, you know. Even if you were there and had seen it, you couldn't explain it. Things Jesus did, walking on water, telling storms to be quiet, turning water into wine, making a paste out of mud and rubbing it on a blind man's eyes and sending him to wash, and He gets to see. You can't explain that. There's no way to explain it. So how on earth do we tell the world? How do I speak to that young man I was talking to on Wednesday evening who said, John, you can't possibly expect me to believe all this stuff. Really? Paul says, here's the answer. The church's job is not to explain. The church's job is to demonstrate by its very existence that who Jesus said he was is who he actually is. That when you come here among this group of people, you experience something that enables you to know that what God says is true. The church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. When that building is finished, you won't see the pillars or the foundation or the support beams that hold the whole structure together. You won't see them. They'll be buried in concrete and plaster and wood. But they'll still be there doing their job. What you will see is an incredible building, an amazing resource that we're going to be able to use to forward God's kingdom in this place. What you're going to experience is the presence of God and the activities that we do in there. Children and young people and adults coming to faith in Christ and reaching out to the community. That's what you're going to see. You're not going to see the frame behind it that's holding the whole thing together, making it possible. And that's what the church is. Because when the church is really the church, you don't see the church. You only see Jesus. That's what Paul's saying. Increasingly and more, what we are will become focused on him. And people who talk about us won't talk about us. They'll talk about the Jesus they met when they were with us. They'll talk about the Jesus whose lordship they understood to be true because they became a part of the life of this community and they saw what they couldn't explain. I spent an hour and a half, in a very pleasant hour and a half in a cafe a couple of weeks ago with a young minister who has moved into our presbytery and taken over a church. It's his first church. He'd been assistant for a while before that, and he's kind of quite nervous about his first church, and he's following somebody who's quite well known and in Northern Ireland, and so he's doubly worried about that. You know, how do you succeed somebody like that, and what should he do? And so he emailed me one day and said, John, come meet and have a conversation, just want to pick your brains a bit. And we chatted and talked for about an hour and a half over a very pleasant cup of coffee, which he paid for. It's made it even more pleasant. And at the end of the conversation, just as we were about to leave, he said, thank you. And then he said, John, I'm actually just thinking back in our conversation. He said, you did a really funny thing. I said, well, what was that? Well, he said, for the last hour and a half, you didn't talk about church. You talked about Jesus. I wasn't conscious of doing that. I was just talking about what God had done and answered the questions that he had. I said, well, this is what happened. And I explained how things had moved and changed and how people's lives have been touched. And he said at the end of it, he said, you never talked about church. You talked about Jesus. When church is church, that's what happens. When church is church, we don't talk about ourselves. We're not here to build empires, put up badges, and make everybody think we're great. If we do that, then we're not being church. Because to be church is to become increasingly focused on Jesus. Church is church when it's not church you see, but Christ. That's our vision. It's who we want to be. Three powerful pictures to become increasingly conscious of being the Lord's. We are God's households. It's his right to command and our duty to obey. We need to be more conscious of what he wants. We need to take time to wait on him and to follow his bidding. We need to become increasingly infused with life. We're not here to suck life out of the community. We're here to give life to the community. One of the amazing things, I was at a council meeting a couple of weeks ago reporting back on how we use the money that they've given us in three of our programs. We got some money from the council on their at-risk area strategy, and we've been using that in our CAP ministry, in our youth ministry, and in some of the stuff that Jean has been doing. And we have to go and tell the council what we did with our money, obviously. And we were sitting in the council chamber, and there was a bit of conversation going on. Some of the councillors were there, and we had just given our report. One of the councillors spoke up and kind of let the cat out of the bag a wee bit. He spoke up and he said, well, you see, he said, it's just really interesting to hear this report. Because he said, I remember on council when we were talking about where we would give this money, and loads of people in council said, why would we give any money to that big wealthy church up there? But he said, when I listened to what has happened here, we said, what I realize is, he said, it's not about that big wealthy church up there. It's about their outreach, about the lives they touch and the difference that they're making. They're not sucking life out of the community. They're giving life to the community. To be church is to be infused with the life of God. And to be church is to become increasingly focused on Jesus. We're talking about ourselves, talking about our organizations, and talking about all this sort of stuff. We're not being church. We're only being church when we're a pillar. We're hidden. Nobody sees that we're there. But what we do demonstrates the truth of what Jesus said he was.